I'm William Jess Laird. This is Image Culture. My guest today is the painter Israel Lund. Israel's interested in images, the way they're reproduced, transmitted, and passed through digital and analog systems. His early experiences as a teenager, making zines and posters for local punk shows, introduced him to a visual culture that thrived on the copy, and motivated him to introduce CMYK screen printing techniques into the realm of painting. The aesthetic of his work falls somewhere between abstraction and a glitchy computer screen. And through it all, there's a constant examination of how the information of an image is determined by the system it's put through, be it a Tumblr page, a photocopier, or one of Israel's screens. Here I am with Israel Lund. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Grew up in Vermont.
Yep. What do you want to know? I grew up in Vermont.
I want to know how a Vermont kid gets into punk culture.
It's very hard. I mean, I would go to Massachusetts mostly for shows and things
Boston?
Like that. Boston and Worcester and Springfield, places like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think I was interested in music when I was a kid, just paying attention to music.
You play?
No, but it was always just something that I gravitated towards. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was just when you're growing up in Vermont, there's not a ton to do. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of, look for music, I guess,
What'd your parents listen to? What was in the house growing up?
My dad took me to Robert Cray. Do you know him?
Yes, the guitar player?
Yeah. That was my first show, actually.
That's a great first show.
Yeah. That's what I would listen to a lot when I was a kid. What else? George Thorogood, mm-hmm. I really liked. My dad used to, on the weekends, he would always be playing music really loud. Mm-hmm. And cooking and doing things around the house. And so it's a really fond memory that I have, mm-hmm. of going downstairs and listening to his music, you know? Mm-hmm.
I feel that's kind of what makes up our musical backgrounds. It's what your parents listened to and then what you kind of rebelled against with.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
What I mean? And
exactly.
It's always a really weird kind of cross because they rarely go hand in hand.
Yeah. I guess some of it has a little bit. He would tell me about how he went to go see Black Sabbath and stuff, and I thought that was cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
I was like, whoa, my dad's cool.
Was he like a rocker? What did he
yeah,
do?
Yeah, kind of.
Where'd he grow up?
Vermont, same town. Uh-huh. When we bought the house that my parents live in now, mm-hmm. you can walk to the edge of the property and look down and see the farm where my grandparents used to live.
Oh, so, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous.
Stuck close by. What did he do?
He was a mason and a carpenter and that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
Did you learn any of those skills? I mean, was that sort of... I guess I'm curious, so where was art in your constellation as a kid?
Yeah,
it making? Were you doing carpentry at all? Or?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I would do stuff with him, but he never showed me how to lay bricks or anything. Mm-hmm. But it was mostly through skateboarding is where I would build stuff, and I would ask him how to build something, and he would tell me.
Skate ramps
and stuff? Yeah, of course. So, and then the art thing, I don't know. I kind of always was just making things, but never knew that it was kind of that there was other people that were making them, maybe. Mm-hmm. I always had a talent for drawing, and so I would do that a lot. We didn't travel a lot as a kid, so I didn't really know much outside of that. So actually, after I left, when I was 18, I didn't go to college, mm-hmm. right off. I went to Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then started realizing that people were having art shows. And I was like, this is something you can do? Mm-hmm. I had been to museums as a kid, but I didn't really put the two things together.
It's far away.
Yeah. This is artwork that's here in this building. And there was no in between. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Of course, I knew people made it, but it didn't make sense to me that you could show it in the middle area.
What was the reason you were drawn to Portland?
Skateboarding.
Does Portland hold a special place in skate culture?
Well, they have a world famous skate park there called Burnside. This DIY skate park under the bridge.
And you went for the skate. Were you how? Yeah. What was your best trick at your peak? At your peak, what'd you have?
Know.
What could you what
know.
Could you throw?
I don't know.
Everyone's watching. It's your turn to drop it. What are you gonna?
Throw? I don't know. After a while, I kind of just didn't care about doing tricks anymore. Mm-hmm. I just kind of really liked having style and smooth, and having it be smooth. I don't know.
You're into the culture of it.
Or the feeling, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just concentrated less on tricks and just flowing.
You're the guy who's kind of going around the perimeter of the park, making comments on everyone else's thing. Yeah, uh-huh.
Sure, yeah, if that's that's my flowing.
So when you get to Portland, I mean, like, is that you're just hanging out with skaters? I mean, what was your community like at the
kind
time?
Kind of, yeah. And I started going to a lot of shows and stuff, mm-hmm. like punk shows and things like that, like house shows, and so I started to get more, you know, friends that way, mm-hmm. and hardcore shows and things like that.
What was the scene like?
Pretty small, mm-hmm. and weird. And the guy had come from a pretty big scene, like going to shows in Boston and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you go to like a tiny little show in Portland and, you know, it felt stunted or something. I don't know.
What was like the first things that you were making?
I was doing a lot of sculpture and just kind of, I don't know. It was weird because after I moved to Portland, I didn't really make all that much stuff. I was kind of, like I said, skateboarding a lot, kind mm-hmm. of seeing the country. I didn't stay in Portland all that long. I kind of went back and forth mm-hmm. until I went to undergrad.
Road like trips? Later.
Road trips, riding freight trains, hitchhiking.
Like, really?
Yeah.
That's why. Do you actually on a train?
Oh, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. You have any stories?
Yeah.
How was it?
It's great. I mean, if anybody has any inkling to do it, they should. I think it's amazing. You see a lot of different stuff that you don't see just taking like a car or whatever, and it's kind of amazing to just be in this crazy boxcar in the middle of nowhere. It's so loud and dirty and but so fun.
It's a very romanticized thing to do.
Yeah,
but I kind of don't think of it as being like a, I'm trying to think of like the time that I situate that in. I think of like, do you ever see that movie I'm Not There? You know the Bob Dylan movie?
No,
it's Todd Haynes.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a hobo thing.
This is like the early thousands. Like, what's the deal? Are you getting hitched? Are people like throwing you off these cars? Like, how? Wait, no, rousted? Is that
rousted?
I want to say the phrase rousted by the bulls. See, I feel like that's like old timey Western.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I never got rousted. So, I never got arrested or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I used to do it a lot when I lived in Florida because it was really easy. Mm-hmm. I lived in a punk house in Florida and didn't really pay that much rent. Mm-hmm. So if I got bored, I would just ride a freight train to like outside of Jacksonville and go to Gainesville and hang out with my friends there for a couple of days and things like that.
So the first work, you work in this really specific way, you mm-hmm. know, and how'd you arrive at silk screening? Through zines?
Yeah. I mean, I've known how to do all that stuff since high school. Mm-hmm. Like it goes hand in hand with like going to shows or putting on shows or making zines or
in what way?
You know, you just kind of if you're into that subculture or whatever, or were into it or whatever, most of the time people are making things to promote their friend's band or their mm-hmm. own band or the show that's coming up or whatever, you know. And so when I was in Florida, I was actually doing some different shows that like organizing shows, music shows there, mm-hmm. and I really liked making the flyers for them. Mm-hmm. That was the exciting part for me. So I then would like silkscreen a lot of stuff or what have you. But yeah, I've just always known how to silkscreen. So when I went to grad school, I had just come from an undergrad where I felt was very conceptual, if you will, mm-hmm. idea driven,
theory driven.
Yeah, theory driven, yeah. And yeah. Which was on the West Coast in mm-hmm. Portland, Oregon. And so then when I went to the East Coast, it felt very more studio driven. Mm-hmm. And so my first semester, I kind of made a bunch of stuff thinking like, oh, I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to do some weird stuff that I don't know about. And then none of it felt right. And I just asked myself, like, what do I want to be making? Mm-hmm. Painting was really exciting to me. And I had been making paintings before. Mm-hmm. And silk screening just came naturally. And it also happened that nobody was really using the silk screening studio. Mm-hmm. I went to Rutgers in mm-hmm. New Jersey. So they weren't really using it. So it was kind of my own little extra studio.
Yeah.
Then that became a thing. So I just started like silk screening on canvas, and I realized that it looked like something that I had made before, like blown up photocopies and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I was making black and white paintings at the time. Mm-hmm. And so then I just made them 8.5 by 11, and mm-hmm. they look like photocopies to me. And so I just told myself, like, well, if they look like photocopies and the size of a piece of paper, I might as well just photocopy them. Mm-hmm. So I photocopied that, like a bunch of these small paintings, and then used those black and white images to make colored ones. And I realized that
to create the screens in order
to. But I was the backup, I was using like what I would call an open screen. So I was using the tools for silk screening, but I wasn't necessarily, didn't have to adhere to the constraints mm-hmm. of silk screening. They became like monoprints. And then when I photocopied them, I realized that I could put the black and white high contrast image back into silk screening. And then, you know, I was like, well, what do I want to just do black and white again? Mm-hmm. I was like, that seems boring. I can mm-hmm. just, you know, everybody knows what happens when you photocopy a photocopy and photocopy that photocopy and so on and so
forth.
Starts
to disintegrate.
Yeah, exactly. And people have done that a bunch of times and much better than I could. So it didn't make any sense. But so then I just decided to follow the printing logic, which so then I just used CMYK. But it was kind of this de facto CMYK process, like where if you know anything about printing, it's, you know, each one has certain dot numbers and the density of the dots make color, essentially. Mm-hmm. So when you overlap them. Mm-hmm. But since it was all the same image, but I was just using the same image with three different colors, like cyan, magenta, and yellow, mm-hmm. it kind of worked in the same way, but not. Mm-hmm. And so that's where like the painting mentality kind of came in.
Right.
And I realized that since I wasn't adhering to the constraints of silk screening and I was kind of looking at it through a painting lens, I could kind of vary all the outcomes, essentially. And so if I made 10 of the same paintings, they would all hypothetically be the same, but they would be different because they would have, the colors would be different, like depending on the how much ink I used or the pressure and things like that.
So that's where your manipulation comes into it.
Yeah, exactly.
You said that your undergrad was this kind of theory-driven exercise. Mm-hmm. And then obviously when you start making this sort of work, it's very studio-driven. Mm-hmm. What was the initial response to this work? Like amongst
the students or the...
Yeah, your students, your professors. Like what'd they say about it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't remember. I think I was just working really fast then. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of just working through ideas on my own. So I don't necessarily remember what they said.
It's probably a good thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You like didn't care. You're like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. I was more asking myself questions of like, where can I go next? What do I need to do for this? Like mm-hmm. things of that nature.
Like it's funny that you kind of recoil from this sort of theory-driven, you know, way of thinking about it. Because there is like sort of a lot to get into kind of theory-wise with these, right? Because the gesture, that idea of creating an image from the silk screening system itself, you know, like a non-image, right? Yeah. And then manipulating it through these different processes, like when you photocopy it, you're putting it through a different process than making a screen of that. There's a lot in there that is kind of like, I think, kind of theory driven about like how we relate to images. And, you know, I mean,
Absolutely.
Were you at the beginning, were you thinking about this kind of idea of like the digital versus the analog? I mean, how were you relating to those ideas?
I mean, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that before I started grad school, I was pretty active on Tumblr and just thinking about images and in their dissemination and things like that.
What was your Tumblr like?
You should check it out. It's just, it's all art, but I kind of set up a constraint for myself where I would try and kind of link each image. Mm-hmm. So there would be an aspect like either formally or what I knew about the work that was happening kind of conceptually or whatever the information was that I thought connected to the next one. It was only really for myself because I don't know if everybody could follow, you know, necessarily.
Yeah, right.
It was more of just like an exercise or a fun thing for me to do. Mm-hmm. But I was also at the same time, you know, putting my own stuff on there and kind of watching how that was happening. And there were a lot of other people doing the same kind of thing around that time. Mm-hmm. So like 2009 or so. Yeah, I just got really interested in how images function in the world. And so that was one way that they were being disseminated. And like platforms were interesting, like the interfaces, mm-hmm. you know, meaning Tumblr or Flickr or whatever. And those kind of influenced the way that I was thinking about just image making and how images work. And then painting seemed like a very, not an analog version of it, but it felt like a place where that could also be, mm-hmm. Like painting could be put into that equation or something.
Like there's this term that comes up a lot, like when I'm reading about your image, your paintings, which is like the analog JPEG. How do you relate to that idea?
Well, yeah, that's what it kind of came out of. Thinking about Tumblr and watching what happens when people put an image out there, depending mm-hmm. on, you know, not just it being liked or what have you, but the way it gets reshared or the way it comes back to you, whether it's degraded, mm-hmm. you know, the more times somebody takes a JPEG off of Tumblr or any other website and puts it on their, you know, desktop or something and then puts it onto a new platform or something, mm-hmm. it breaks down. So I thought that was really interesting and that felt very sculptural or something to me. So I started thinking about JPEGs and images as objects, and that mm-hmm. seemed very helpful or beneficial to me. So that's, I guess, what I was thinking about with analog JPEG. So then I've treated my paintings in a similar way.
How so?
For one show, I had... Well, the gallery had these windows in the front that were... Well, these doors that could open.
Are you talking about 11 Rivington?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So,
show from 2013.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
See, I did my homework.
All right. But yeah, so I put those on the front of the window so that for a couple of different reasons. One, so that people had to go in and actually look at the paintings, mm-hmm. you know, because with that space, people could walk by and be like, oh yeah, I saw the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of also another thing too, like Contemporary Art Daily. Yeah, like Contemporary Art Daily was really popular. Mm-hmm. So I think for a long time, people thought that they had seen shows because they had seen it online. So I wanted to make people go in and actually look at the paintings themselves.
Yeah.
So I wanted also, like, the hypothetically, if you went at 10 a.m., they would be a different painting if you went than if you went at 4 p.m.
Based on the way the light's coming into
exactly.
the back of it.
And so, like, obviously, I was playing with the idea of, like, a backlit image, mm-hmm. hence the analog JPEG.
You made this work using the image of a Daniel Buren painting, mm-hmm. Hanging at Petzl Gallery, was it?
Yeah.
The source material of this painting, the initial source material, is this cell phone photograph you made of Daniel Buren's work with, yeah. And you can even see the flash,
yeah, exactly.
the sort of imprint of your cell phone's flash, like in the painting very faintly. What was your relationship to Daniel Buren? What motivated you to use that in the work?
Yeah, I started using the Daniel Buren image because it was a twofold thing. Like I had a show that was scheduled, and the space of the show, there were two walls that I could use. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the space were these columns. So I was thinking about the eventual install images mm-hmm. that would be taken, and also how one would navigate the space. So I was thinking about looking across the room at the paintings mm-hmm. and that sometimes they might be bisected by these columns that were there.
Yeah.
So I thought about, oh, well, I'm just going to make the content of the paintings reflect that in a way. Mm-hmm. I was interested in using other people's artwork because I had been taking photographs of my own paintings and making new paintings off of those, and I, you know, you can just do that ad infinitum and it gets boring. Like photographing or photocopying a photocopy and then photocopying that photocopy is really just, we all know what happens.
And also using these kind of like these apps, like this PDF generating app.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I started using the PDF making app because it works basically in the same way as a photocopier. It makes it look like a photocopy.
Like radically reducing the amount of actual information.
Making it into a high contrast image.
Yeah.
And just like kind of, making it very noisy and mm-hmm. kind of, which I really like. It just kind of obliterates it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like a logical next step in terms of, well, I have a phone, I'm taking photos, I'm distributing images, thinking about paintings. Why not photograph this thing that's in front of me right now mm-hmm. and use it in my own work? And then it felt like a faux pas to use other people's artwork, but I kind of wanted to push myself and think about it in a different way mm-hmm. and use a recognizable image to kind of like hook somebody mm-hmm. so that then they would start thinking about it differently.
Yeah.
That kind of led me down using other people's artworks.
Like what other artworks are you starting to use and incorporate into the work?
Well, after the Buren one, I kind of use these Kippenberger doodles because mm-hmm. everybody just kept saying like, oh, you must really love Daniel Buren. And I was kind of like, nah, not really. I don't know.
Like, you mean people like me?
No, no. Exactly. Plebes. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, of course.
Just people. And it's a normal, mm-hmm. you know, reading of an artwork or something. But I wanted to kind of make fun of myself for using that.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about like just ham-fistedly using, like going, you know, leaning into it or just kind of like doubling down on it and using something that's even more iconic, essentially. It's like mm-hmm. a Kippenberger. And so it was just kind of stupid. And I kind of liked that.
But same deal. Like, is it like, did you have like a real relationship with Kippenberger before this work? Or are you just thinking like what will grab people in that sense?
Yeah. It's not necessarily I have some kind of affinity to him.
So it's not really even really a taste thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of transferring information mm-hmm. from one thing to the next. And like, there's a recognition factor that I wanted to have. Like mm-hmm. people, if they recognize that it's Kippenberger doodles or it's just added information that will lead to like a new reading of it, mm-hmm. maybe.
I also want to talk about this painting, Untitled Severed Head, which is another painting that incorporates this kind of like immediately recognizable imagery. And especially because like when I think of the severed head, I think of it as having like a pretty complex iconography, mm-hmm. you know, because there's this reading of it where it's like you know, Jason slaying the Medusa is like the classical, like that's something that exists in like classical painting and classical art. But then we also have sort of very contemporary readings of that where you think of like ISIS, or you think of like, you know, terrorism.
Yeah, absolutely. This,
I mean, where does that actual, where does the image of the severed head that you're using come from?
It came from a still of a TV show. I can't even remember what TV show it was, but I looked at a lot of severed head images, which is not advisable. But it was, it got me thinking about what I, not necessarily what I was allowed to use, I guess, but what I would feel good in using. Mm-hmm. Like, I had no problem taking this Daniel Buren or Martin Kippenberger image.
Yeah.
But as I started looking at the severed heads that are, you know, accessible to you online, a lot of them have nothing to do with me or anything that I'm, you know, basically aren't white. So that brings up a huge question of like, should I be using that? Like, that's not, you know, that's actually a real person whose head is severed for other reasons.
And it doesn't exist in this sort of like, in this art conversation in the same way. In that Daniel Buren, it's like, you know, there's the, there, I mean, you describe it as being a faux pas, like putting someone else's work within your own, but it's also like a very accepted, you know, visual strategy.
So it was more of like a, it was interesting for myself to just go through that and ask myself questions of like what I could use, what I was comfortable using and things like that. And it was definitely a non sequitur, in terms of what I've been, had been making. It wasn't a logical next step from what I had been making before. So, but it's gone on to like influence a lot of the things that I've been making now.
How so?
Well, for one, I made, after that, I made a painting called Headless Body, which was just an, like a 60 by 8.5 by 60 rectangle.
Yeah.
60 happens to be basically the my height sans head. So I was like, I already made a severed head painting. I'll make the rest of the body painting, but I wanted to kind of abstract it and stuff. And at the same time, I was asked to do a show in Texas in this place called Culture Hole, which is essentially, I don't even know what it was used, but it's a hole in the ground, like a cement hole in the ground. You can't even stand up in it. So I figured, where's the best place? That's the best place to show a headless body painting in a hole in Texas. But
lots of headless bodies in holes in Texas.
Exactly, I'm sure. and I just started to think more about images, repercussions on the body or people's bodies or things like that, and identity and all the things that come with image dissemination, especially now.
And representation of like a person.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I guess that leads right into, I mean, I know you have these paintings that have the word bodies in them, you know, like where it becomes kind of text. Like the two that come to mind for me are bodies, and then also these paintings that say destroy yourselves, which, and we made this image like shooting, you know, of you like being photographed through this large screen, the large destroy yourselves screen. I suppose let's start with that one. Like, where does that phrase come from, and why do you feel compelled to start putting it into your canvases?
Well, it came from graffiti that was up around Paris in 1968, like leading up to May 68, like the protests and things that happened then. So,
but you don't like Daniel Buren. The signs are all there. I think I think you're just a closeted Daniel Buren lover.
You got me. You got me. And but it also is the name of a film by Serge Bard. So in my last show at David Lewis, we had a night where we screened that film. And I used that opportunity to make a new painting that had a blank rectangle to screen onto. So it was like basically a painting, like an abstract painting that had a rectangle that was left blank or raw canvas. And so then we screened that on there. And then I thought, well, I already screened it on there, I might as well make a painting that says destroy yourselves,
because it felt literally screen it on there.
So it felt very much like taking a photo of one of my other paintings and then making a new painting off of that. It seemed like the same logic, I guess. And then I like how it kind of gets separated from that, you know, it becomes this other thing. The term destroy yourselves becomes this weird, like it's confrontational, but then it's also, you look at it more and it feels like mantra-esque maybe or something. And I really like that.
It's like one of those phrases that change, like the more you say it over and over and over again, it kind of changes meaning.
Yeah, maybe it was also another thing to hook people, you know, make them stand in front of the painting longer than they normally would.
You're making a lot more work than you're letting out, right? Mm-hmm. What's that editing process like? What's your criteria for letting an image out?
It's a good question. Sometimes I like putting out paintings that I don't necessarily like, just so I can kind of like maybe learn from them or something.
Like anti-taste?
Yeah, a little bit. Especially with the abstract. The taste question is an interesting one, because I've had that come up a lot. Mm-hmm. People, you know, I'll have two paintings up and somebody will say, I like this one, but I don't like that one. And then I say the exact opposite, mm-hmm. just based on preference. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's a hard question.
Have you felt that from the point that you began making these paintings to now, is your dexterity in being able to like say, like, I know how to make this look like this? Oh. Have you gotten like way, way better, or can you control things more?
A little bit, but it all depends actually. It depends on the weather that's in the studio, or like if it's cold. I feel like sometimes, yeah, it acts differently. And so then you end up getting different colors or different effects. And then when I scaled up, when I went from 8.5 by 11, or like they were at 8.5 by 11, now they're, you know, 68 by 88, it's essentially the same tools, or it is the same tools, but they're just, everything is just much bigger. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as systematic when I got that big, and I ended up having to ask very painterly questions of mm-hmm. myself, and like how to compose mm-hmm. an image, or how to compose, like, even if it's an abstract painting, like what feels right, mm-hmm. instead of it just being, I made 10 of these, they're all different, this, it fits into this like conceptual framework, mm-hmm. you know, which I thought was really interesting. And it felt like the painting's pushing back against something as well. So the answer is like, no, I don't. I think I know what's going to happen, but I definitely don't. So
when you're in art school, what were your crits like?
I mean, they were fine. It's weird. I remember a lot of people not knowing how to talk about them because they weren't paintings and they mm-hmm. weren't prints.
Yeah.
So I think I never was like a staunch follower of either. So I'm like, I don't know, call them sculptures, I guess. I don't know.
People didn't know where to place
you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if they necessarily knew how to talk about them or something. Not mm-hmm. that they're hard to talk about, but it's interesting to watch people wrestle with that. Like, it doesn't fit the definitions that they normally have mm-hmm. of those things.
It's funny you say that you, like, call them sculptures, right? How do you relate to this idea of painting as sculpture? Do you think of the paintings as sculptures?
No, not necessarily. But, I mean, it goes back to the analog JPEG type of thing.
How so?
Thinking about images as not necessarily sculptures, but objects, mm-hmm. and treating them as such is interesting and exciting to me. And it seems like a way to think about painting, mm-hmm. like a fruitful way to think about painting. I don't know how you can make a painting without thinking about their eventual images or how they're going to be photographed or things like that. So it seems only right to kind of implant that, for me anyways, to imbue that into the paintings themselves before they go out into the world.
Israel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Israel as well as Olivia Smith and David Lewis. I'd also like to send a special thank you to Alex Bacon, who wrote an excellent piece on Israel's work in the Brooklyn Rail that I reference frequently in preparation for this show. Remember, you can see my portrait of Israel in his studio at williamjesslaird.com/imageculture. As well as on Instagram, at William Jess Laird and at Image Culture. Our show is produced by Sarah Levine, and our music is by Jack and Eliza. Thank you so much for listening.